This meeting of the Commission on Law Enforcement Accountability, Community, and Transparency will come to order. We are operating under the governor's emergency orders, and therefore we are required, as a matter of our first item of business, to take the role of the commission. I'll ask commissioners to state where they are and if anyone is with them. I will begin. My name is Gordon McDonald. I am at the Department of Justice in Concord. With me is Kim Schmidt, Kate Giaquinto, and Annie Gagne. Commissioner Quinn, are you on?
Yes, sir. Good afternoon, General, and fellow commission members and the public. Robert Quinn is at 33 Hazen Drive in Concord in my office, and I am joined by Colonel Nathan Noyes.
Thank you. Director Malachi.
Yes, good afternoon all. I am alone and I am at home.
Thank you. Director Skipper.
Good afternoon. This is John Skipper, the Director of New Hampshire Police Standards and Training. I am at 17 Institute Drive at the Police Academy in Concord, and I am joined by the Executive Officer, Major Dave Parento.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson. Rogers, are you there, Mr. Johnson?
Yes, Rogers Johnson. I'm from the Seacoast NAACP, and I'm in my office by myself.
Thank you. Mr. McKim.
Thank you, General, and commissioners and public. This is James McKim. I am in my office at home at Goffstown, New Hampshire, and I am alone.
Thank you. Judge Gardner.
Good afternoon, General McDonald and members of the Commission. I am up in Jackson, New Hampshire. My family is in a separate section of the house.
Thank you, Lieutenant Morrison.
Good afternoon, everyone. Lieutenant Morrison, on behalf of the New Hampshire Police Association, I am located at the Londonderry Police Department in Londonderry, New Hampshire.
Thank you, Chief Dennis.
Hi, Charlie Dennis. Good afternoon, General and fellow commission members. I'm in my office at 46 Lime Road at the Hanover Police Department, and I am alone.
Thank you. Mr. Norton.
Hi, Ken Norton, and I am alone in my home.
Thank you. Mr. Lescott.
Good afternoon to all commission members, members of the public. General, I am at my residence in Bedford, New Hampshire, and I am alone.
Thank you. Attorney Jefferson.
Good afternoon. I am in Manchester, New Hampshire, in my office, and I am alone.
Thank you. Ms. Chella.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm at my residence in Manchester, New Hampshire. My family is in the home with me, but they're not in the room with me.
Thank you very much. Chief Edwards. See you there.
And General Public.
Chief, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Good afternoon, General, Commission members, and General Public. I am in my home in Dover, and I am alone.
Great. Just a reminder to everyone, if you are not speaking, please mute your phones. We are getting some feedback. By way of a technology update, this meeting is being transcribed in real time via communication access real-time translation. There is a link on the Commission's website. If you wish to access that technology that is Commission, it is governor.nh.gov/accountability, governor.nh.gov/accountability, and you will see a link up there for the CART transcription service. A number of members have asked about transforming or having our meetings via video service. I just want to report to the Commission we are working on that. Just by way of explanation, we had to pull together a lot in a very short amount of time, and we accessed the technology that we're using simply because we have used it in so many other platforms during the COVID emergency. But we have heard your message, and I hope we will be able to have our next meeting via video, one of the video technologies. I understand the limitations of this platform, but I think we can all say that nothing is absolutely perfect in our current environment, but we will give that a shot. In terms of our next meeting, there is one date based on our survey that does appear to work for all commission members. So I'm going to ask commission members to please block out from 9:30 to 12 next Thursday, 9:30 to 12 Thursday, July 2nd. And we will get a meeting notice out on that. Next item of business is to approve the minutes from our first meeting, the organizational meeting, which is dated June 22nd, 2020. I hope commission members have had a chance to review those minutes. And if so, I would invite any comments for suggestions or additions or edits. Please raise your hand by pressing 5-star. I see no hands raised. Chief Dennis.
I'm sorry, General. I think I did that wrong. So please remove that.
Thank you. If not, excuse me, I'd entertain a motion for approval of our minutes dated June 22nd, 2020. May I have a motion, please? Mr. Norton?
So moved.
And may I have a second?
Second. Ken Norton, I second it.
Who moved? Who made the motion?
Maybe me.
Mr. Johnson, okay. Motion made by Mr. Johnson, seconded by Mr. Norton. This requires a roll call vote. Commissioner Quinn?
Yes.
Director Malachi?
Yes.
Director Skipa?
Yes.
Mr. Johnson?
Yes.
Mr. McKim?
Yes.
Judge Gardner?
I am abstaining because I was not present for the entire meeting.
Thank you. Lieutenant Morrison?
Yes.
Chief Dennis?
Yes.
Mr. Norton?
Yes.
Mr. Lacaz?
Yes.
Attorney Jefferson?
Yes.
Chief Edwards?
Yes.
And Ms. Chella, I'm sorry I missed you. Ms. Chella?
Yes.
The motion is approved. Thank you very much. Now turning to today's business, I will say that we've got a hard stop at 4:30 today because of staff limitations. So 4:30 today. Our plan today is to resume the testimony of Director Skipa, and where we left off yesterday, we're waiting for the opportunity of Ms. Chella and Chief Edwards to ask their questions of the director. From there, we will hear from Colonel Noyes, and we will do questions in the reverse order, in other words, starting with Chief Edwards and moving up the list. Then we will hear from Chief Dennis. Our subject matter today remains focused on police training issues with special emphasis on de-escalation, use of force, and diversity training. after we hear from Chief Dennis, assuming we have adequate time, we'll begin the public testimony on this subject matter. And again, the subject matter is with respect to police training on those various issues, and we ask members of the public to keep focused on those issues. There will be opportunities down the road to talk about other issues before the commission, but we're really focused on training. I do want to note for the record that Director Skipa has submitted two additional documents. One is a breakdown of academy hours, and the second is a very helpful summary of links to the various resources that he discussed during our time together yesterday. Those documents have been distributed to commission members, and they are up on our website. I will also note that Attorney Jefferson, right before our meeting, has distributed a document to commission members. I have not had a chance to look at it, but I'd note that just the commission members to take a look out for that, and we will also get that up on our website. So with that, Director Skipper, are you ready?
Yes, General, I am.
Okay. Ms. Chawla, go ahead.
Thank you, and thank you, Director Skipper, for your presentation yesterday. So we touched a little bit upon diversity training. My question is, do you feel that the Police Standards and Training Council has sufficient in-house expertise on racism, implicit bias, and diversity to provide effective training on these issues?
As we are presently staffed, no. In my opinion, there are clearly subject matter experts right here in the state that we would rely on to help guide us as we put together a better program than we have now.
Who are the people that are dealing with this training currently?
So the history of who has delivered and helped develop the training, there was a gentleman by the name of Andrew Smith, who I believe is deceased now, but he was the primary subject matter expert that we used to help deliver what we have now, and then he oftentimes would deliver the program to the recruits. My understanding is that gentleman has passed away. We have used, I want to make sure that this is the case, but I'm pretty sure that Chief Edwards has had the opportunity to present this block of instruction, and also I believe as an assistant, Lieutenant Carlos Camacho from the Nashua Police Department has also come in to assist. We also have one staff member here, Lieutenant Jerry Taylor, who has also presented that block of instruction over the last few years. But in terms of developing an actual viable lesson plan going forward, I would not rely on anyone in-house to direct that effort, and believe that there are subject matter experts that are have already stepped forward and are working towards making that happen for us.
Okay. Thank you.
All set?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you. Chief Edwards.
Thank you, General, for the opportunity, and thank you, Director Skipper, for the presentation yesterday. And you are correct. The current program, just for informational purposes, the current program was developed by Andrew Smith. And Andrew Smith has developed a number of actual training programs throughout the state for police interaction with youth and several other programs. And he was a primary facilitator of the program. I have also taught the program along with several other police officers in the state. The program, as it currently stands, is heavily dependent upon instructors, the instructors' knowledge and experiences and their own expertise. So I do think we need a more robust program, and the director's correct that a number of people have come together to really make sure that New Hampshire's program is one of the best models in the country. So, and I feel very confident with Director Skipper's leadership that that will certainly happen. I just have two things in regards to training. One, when it comes to use of force, I know that the Attorney General's manual is a good guide for law enforcement and understanding the use of force. But in terms of a statewide policy for consideration, for the commission to consider perhaps as a statewide policy on the use of force, where the training at that point becomes more consistent for all law enforcement officers throughout the state, regardless of their department or at the state, local, or county. I offer that because there are multiple different use of force policies, and the training for those policies are very different. So I think that would be one area that we could consider developing a training model around that every single police department has. So if you're shoring up the back of a fellow officer, they are aware of your level of training, you're aware of their level of training, so it's consistent. That would be the point I would offer at this point.
And to Chief Edwards' remarks, it's important for the commission members and the general public to understand that a vast majority of the time in New Hampshire, when there is an emergency call where police are responding, it is absolutely the usual case that multiple officers from multiple agencies will respond to that same call to assist each other, just by virtue of the fact that there are so many smaller police departments in the state. And so to Chief Edwards' point, that certainly would make things more transferable with regard to the training and the understanding of use of force.
Okay, Chief, is Chief Edwards anything else?
No, just one other question. Again, this is for the director as well. Director, if you could just explain just briefly in terms of compliance with training, or is your unit properly staffed? Would you need more staff to actually go out into the field and properly monitor a law enforcement agency? They're training with compliance or investigations to fail to comply with a area of responsibility?
The quick answer is that in my estimation, we do not have an adequate staff to accomplish that. Presently, I have one part-time employee who's fully tasked with that responsibility, along with other major responsibilities here. And then we have one other part-time training specialist that assists with actually doing the audits. And so in essence, we have two part-time training specialists that whose primary responsibility is to conduct these types of compliance audits.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chief.
Thank you very much, Chief Edwards. Director, I want to thank you for some really excellent testimony, and I want to thank you for submitting the links. I'm also wondering whether it would be possible to see the lesson plan for what the Academy is using for the course, which is called Cultural Dynamics. And, excuse me, whether... You mentioned yesterday in your testimony that your working group of subject matter experts is looking at least one lesson plan from another state. I believe that's Ohio, and I would be very interested in seeing that. Would it be possible to provide that to the commission?
Absolutely, General. I'll make sure that those two documents are sent to Ms. Schmidt as soon as this is over.
Great. Well, thank you again.
And General, if I could very quickly, I feel silly, but I just want to amend a couple of things from yesterday.
Yes.
Oh,
please.
Thank you. There was an individual on the commission, and I failed to remember who it was that asked with regard to the total number of training hours to the full-time police academy, and I said it hovered right around 650, and then later on asked to amend that to about 590. I forget what the amendment was, 594. In fact, I did more research, and the list that I sent out today reflects a total number of hours of 684. Also on that list of hours as broken down by topic, I testified yesterday that there was 16 hours devoted to mental illness dynamics. You're going to see that it says 16 hours are dedicated to that, but in fact, it's 16 classroom hours. And if you go to the third page of the 36 hours for the scenario and simulator training, 8 of those hours are committed to the mental health interaction training. So just for clarification, there was also another question asked about the police sanitation training budget. The 2020 check that the 2020 total budget for our operation here is $3,424,197, and for 21, it's $3,472,749. Of that total budget, we average between $70,000 and $80,000 per year for us to accomplish providing in-service training, and that fluctuates based on one other variable. But that's the total number of training dollars available. And then finally, I would say that there was a request relative to the members of the New Hampshire Police Standards and Training Council, and I just sent a link to Ms. Schmidt to put forth to all the members from our webpage that lists all the council members. In general, that is all I have to offer.
Thank you again, Director Skipa. So through the director's testimony, we've heard about training that currently exists at our statewide police academy, through which all law enforcement officers in our state pass, virtually all. Our charge also asks us to take a look at training curriculum, procedures, and policies developed by state police, which is, of course, our largest statewide law enforcement agency, and to ask and examine areas for improving, including with respect to de-escalation, use of deadly and non-deadly force, and diversity training. So our next witness is prepared to present on that, and he is Colonel Nathan Noyes, who is the director of the Division of State Police at the New Hampshire Department of Safety. And Colonel Noyes, if you're on, I invite you to proceed.
Thank you, General. And I just want to thank the commission for having me today. It's a great honor to be here to represent the New Hampshire State Police and to speak in part on behalf of all of our law enforcement agencies throughout the state. And thank you to the commission for the responsibility each of you are undertaking for this huge responsibility. So thank you.
Colonel, may I just interrupt briefly? I neglected to note that you have presented slides. Commission members have them. And for members of the public who wish to follow along with the Colonel's presentation, those slides can be found on the website under our Thursday, June 25th. It's captioned Colonel Nathan A. Noyes, New Hampshire State Police. And I apologize, Colonel.
No, General, that's quite okay. Thank you, sir. So just to start for the commission with a slight background of the New Hampshire State Police, which was formed in 1937, just to give a brief background, we're approximately 350 sworn officers. And when I say officers, that encompasses New Hampshire State Troopers, that encompasses full-time Marine Patrol officers, and the office and police force that we have at the state office complex over at the New Hampshire Hospital. We then have an approximate 50 part-time officers that also complement our sworn force. On any given year, the New Hampshire State Police, just to kind of put it in scope, we conduct approximately 123,000 motor vehicle stops, approximately 85,000 calls for service come through our division, investigate over 5,000 accidents, and arrest approximately 5,500 arrests a year is what we handle. We're unique in size and in scope in that we have an aviation unit, Marine Patrol unit, as I spoke about, and, of course, we have our troopers that patrol the entire state in every county within. So to start with our mission statement on slide 2, New Hampshire State Police is dedicated to providing the highest degree of law enforcement service throughout the state of New Hampshire while maintaining the traditions of fairness, professionalism, and integrity. And that mission statement is important, as I want the commission and the members of our general public that are listening to know that any candidate that comes through this division or this department, they see that on our websites. They see that through our recruitment and training unit and the emails they receive as they go through the candidate pool testing. They see that prior to testing on the day they show up for their physical agility test and to take their written test. They hear that from our recruitment and training commander as they stand on stage and seek to obtain a profession in law enforcement. And then when they go through their oral board, they have to review that mission statement and articulate what it means to them. So that is key to our organization. In creating this presentation for the commission, this slide is essentially, this presentation is essentially to assist the commission with researching and formulating recommendations on how law enforcement can better serve our communities. And I specifically focused on our training, both the general training that we receive and specific de-escalation training that the division receives, in addition to our professional standards and policies. And in that, I focused on use of force and our professional standards unit and what exactly that unit does. That's something that's not unique just to the New Hampshire State Police, but to many agencies in the state. But my agency is certainly proud of our professional standards unit and what they do on a daily basis. I'd also, right before I get to training, would like to talk briefly about our hiring process. So the New Hampshire State Police, again, this is not unique to us, but many agencies follow this same method, and it kind of speaks to the caliber of the applicant that we are looking for to be a police officer in New Hampshire and specifically with this organization. There's a physical agility testing where they have to maintain certain standards, attain and maintain certain standards. There's a written test, an oral board that they have to go through. A thorough background investigation is conducted. There's also an interview with myself prior to being hired. But in addition, I want to draw attention to there's a polygraph examination that is given that many states don't require, but several agencies or many agencies in this state do. We are one of them. And there's also a psychological test that has to be conducted through the to complete the applicant's hiring process. So that is unique to many agencies in New Hampshire. And starting with our training, based on the presentation given by Director Skippa, that is our foundation for any police agency in the state, and specifically the New Hampshire State Police. The training and certification through PSTC is the foundation for everything we do. We also receive training from other agencies or other organizations. One of them is the New England State Police Administrators Compact, that's NESPAC, and that consists of the six state police agencies in New England. And a lot of the training we receive there includes our EVOC program, which is Emergency Vehicle Operation, firearms instructor training, tactical training. We train with the other state police tactical units. We receive and instruct supervisor and leadership training and women's leadership training. For the past 4 years, there's been a women's leadership conference, and if COVID hadn't taken place this year, New Hampshire and the New Hampshire State Police would have hosted that conference on behalf of NESPAC. We received training from the International Association of Chiefs of Police, specifically best practices and policy development classes, leadership in police organizations, LPO, which is called, and that is specifically for leadership roles or command-type positions. We send our employees to certified public supervisor and certified public manager classes throughout the state and through the state. And we also are able to take advantage of regional and national training opportunities. And one such that I bring up that I was fortunate enough to attend is the FBI's National Law Enforcement Academy, where the class that I went through in the fall of 2018 encompassed 251 police officers, and I believe it was over 28 different countries. So there's certainly a wide variety of experience and techniques that are taught at that incredible training opportunity. We are a very heavy, training-heavy organization. From day one, when someone comes through the door of one of our employees, we set our expectations, accountability, and responsibility. We have a three-week training academy in-house that we like to do prior to our troopers or officers attending Director Skippin's team's PSDC academy. And during that time, professional standards and policy review is part of that three-week course. Over the last 2 years, we have increased our training budget significantly. We've made a conscious effort to do that where we could. Getting to our specific training for state police, as Director Skippa said, his team provides a foundation for all law enforcement and maintains the requirements set forth for each of our agencies. The New Hampshire State Police tries to double down, almost quadruple down, on what those bare minimums are. And I will say it can be a challenge for us as we're spread out through the entire state and we are so significant in size and scope to get everyone into those types of trainings. But those trainings are identified. 4 times a year, we train quarterly on what we refer to as somewhat the basics, whether that is a firearms type course in the spring and the fall, where we ensure that our troopers and officers are receiving training in both the daytime and at night, a winter defensive tactics use of force class, or a summer simulations class. This training really encompasses statutory law, case law policy, and recent case reviews, and it's very scenario-based. All of our training is heavy both in classroom and in practical application. Every trooper goes through emergency vehicle operators course. We're very proud of the search and seizure training that we've been able to put on to all of our folks in conjunction with 896 local police officers that also have attended. And I am currently on slide 4. This training was put together in conjunction with federal and state partners, U.S. Attorney's Office, the Attorney General's Office, and we also have defense attorneys that contribute to this training. The field training and evaluation program is a training program that every new trooper has to go through upon completion of the police academy. They are sent to a troop station where they are required to pass a number of different areas and minimum qualifications. We have recently increased our field training evaluation program days from 35 if you had prior certification with another law enforcement agency, and 50 if you did not, to 50 and 65 respectively. So for a new trooper coming out of the academy with no prior experience, they will receive 65 days of training with various field training officers throughout the state. I noted mandatory policy review, and you're going to hear me speak about our fair and impartial policing policy, which is something that our agency is very proud of. This training is completed and it's tracked in our Moodle program, so every trooper or officer that has to sign off on this, we are able to document when and how it was signed off on. Lastly, all of our troopers and police officers go through response to active shooter training. We are able to train the entire division and a number of local agencies in this training. And I'd like to note here, we strive as a division and we strive as an agency to anticipate and adapt to the challenges that are coming in from our communities. And back in 2010 and 2011, when there were many active shooter incidents taking place across the world and specifically across our nation, this division was in a position where we had not only been training in how to respond to that, but we had also been working in conjunction with a lot of our municipal partners. And we were able to jointly work on training Within 10 weeks in 2011, approximately 500 local police officers to get everyone on the same page and up to speed and how to respond to that type of incidents. We've also created training programs for response to active shooter for civilian businesses, for a business owner, you know, or other state agencies that are civilian oriented, in order to help them prepare for a type of situation like that that may arise in their business area. This is not the only the only area where we have tried to be ahead of the curve or try to prepare and anticipate future challenges coming our way. You're going to hear me talking about our peer support unit here in a moment, mental health and wellness coordination and training for our folks, and again, as I mentioned, our fair and impartial policing policy. You know, I think it was Mr. Johnson and Mr. McKim who talked about a specific emphasis on certain issues. I think it was Mr. McKim yesterday who talked about, you know, a specific injury versus treating the entire body per se, you know, and as we adapt to the challenges, you know, we certainly strive to adapt quickly and to be a leader in those areas. And we do so in conjunction with Director Skipa and his team at PSTC and providing whatever support we can to them at all times and our other law enforcement agencies. Moving on to the next slide, titled Peer Unit Creation and Training. Our peer unit was implemented in 2010, and it was under the vision of then-Major Russ Ponte, who deserves all, if not certainly most, of the credit regarding this, and the commissioner, of course, at the time. This initial training back in 2008, it was the vision under then-Colonel Booth, and Major Conti researched it, traveled to Pennsylvania, gathered a lot of research, and basically from 2008 to present, I'll go over how this unit has kind of adapted. But that was when the concept was originated, and I think it's important to point out that creating a peer support unit was really the focus to remove stigma for police officers and to make it okay to talk about, you know, certain feelings and certain stresses they have in their life and to make us more aware, you know, that it's okay to freely talk about that. It's okay to have mental health professionals within our ranks to make sure that we're in a good place, because we believe that a healthy, well-trained, prepared police officer provides better services to those in our community. Mental health awareness and de-escalation started in 2014 with the assistance of Director Norton in NAMI, New Hampshire, where we were able to create a 45-minute video which dealt with de-escalation. It focused on different psychosis, how to respond to different scenarios, and there were practical exercises for viewing. That was a big deal to us. That was something we took a lot of pride in those videos depicting a police officer, a state trooper specifically, in uniform, handling these types of situations. It was mandatory viewing for all of our sworn personnel, and you can see the numbers reflected there, approximately 339 troopers in 14 and 372 in 2018. In addition, in 2014, each troop station received a presentation on de-escalation techniques and case studies, excuse me. And that is put on by Lieutenant Frank Harris. Lieutenant Harris works out of our state office complex police force over at the New Hampshire Hospital. And he is revered as an expert in that field. He is an instructor at PSTC. He teaches a variety of classes on mental health awareness, whether it's at the police academy, whether it's for our local county or federal law enforcement agencies several times a year. But he also provides a four-hour block of instruction for clinical and other professionals, such as state at different hospitals throughout the state, throughout the DMV. He's also provided this type of training there. He provides what is called secure training, which is safer environments through collaborative and unified response to emergencies. And he's done that 19 times at 19 different hospitals over the past 2 years. And he also teaches crisis management prevention. He's taught at the national level four different times and at once at an international symposium on the secure model. So we're very fortunate to have Lieutenant Harris with us based on his expertise and to be able to utilize him whenever we can. In 2016, we started unconscious bias training and made that a priority. I will note that the state police does provide a number of instructors to PSTC and the police academy, whatever they're asked for and whatever subject matter expertise our trooper may have. We present provide a cadre member for each academy class, and we have a selection process through the division in order to accomplish or decide on which trooper is going to go. That trooper has to be a field training officer, has to have expertise in how to train and the troopers that have come through and have had to be able to demonstrate that over a period of time. Moving on to the next slide, in 2016 and 18, we started sending troopers to the Nicholas J. Haley Symposium, where there's training put forth there on unconscious bias, mental health and society's guardians, and as Director Skipper, you heard talk about, you know, the warrior versus the guardian mindset, and we certainly promote the guardian mindset here in New Hampshire's law enforcement. 2017, all members attended substance misuse, identification, and intervention training. This addressed substance abuse, mental health concerns, and suicide prevention. I know Director Norton mentioned yesterday something along those lines. Again, this is back in 2017 where we focused on the belief that a healthy, aware, well-prepared, and well-trained police officer certainly provides better services to our communities, and we certainly wanted to make that a priority. 2018, the division under Colonel Wagner created mental health and wellness coordinator and made it a position. I believe it is one of the only positions in the entire nation with a state police agency. I believe Connecticut just added one recently, but Colonel Wagner, under the direction of Commissioner Quinn, was certainly innovative in creating that position, identifying what the needs were for the division and providing a resource not only for state police, but for other agencies throughout the state. And since then, the peer unit has been registered with the International Critical Incident Stress Foundation. Moving on to the next slide, 2018 to date, crisis intervention team training, so that's CIT training. Again, in conjunction with NAMI New Hampshire, we're able to obtain a grant-funded training, and this is based off of the Memphis model, and anyone with some experience in CIT training will know that this is a 40-hour training block, which encompasses classroom and practical training. So we really make a focus for our troopers to get to this. And over a three-year period, the grant is going to allow for 225 troopers. Focusing on the CIT training, I believe, and I would have to get further information on it, but the average for a police department to have the number of officers trained in this type of training is very low. It's, I believe it's in the single digits, maybe 8 to 10%. Once this is complete for the New Hampshire State Police, we will far exceed that. Just to remind everybody, I am on slide number 7. In 2018, again, getting back to Director Norton's comment from yesterday, we had resiliency and wellness training by Breachpoint Consulting. And what this did is this really focused on internal stresses that police officers may face and how to recognize those stresses and how to address it and how to cope with it. It focused on the responsibilities of being a police officer and how to cope with the challenges that may come with it. We made a priority in 3 days to get 270 of our troopers through this training. And as we're at approximately 352 Right now, and that includes our troopers, and that includes our police force with Marine Patrol full-time and state office complex. That was a hugely successful moment for the division to be able to get that many people through that training in 3 days. And additionally, the next year, in 2019, regional training was held on the same topic, where we were able to send an additional 17 troopers. We are continually looking at new training all the time. Right now, focusing on implicit bias training, where we have a couple options coming up that we've already been looking at through Caliber Press and diversity, equity, and inclusion. Moving on to the next slide, which is going to be titled Professional Standards, Policy, and Procedure. This one focuses on Chapter 1, our rules and regulations, and much like the training that we receive at the Police Academy, and that being our foundation for our entire career or the foundation of the training that we're going to receive. The rules and regulations governing the New Hampshire State Police is the foundation of any other policy or general order or special order or training bulletin that is pushed out through the entire division. This is intended for the guides of division members so they can be informed of their responsibilities and the general areas of the rules and regulations pertain to obedience, obligations, performance expectation, use of weapons, our rank structure, relief from duty, restoration to duty, personal conduct, division property, and discipline. Also included in our rules and regulations is our mission statement, which everyone has already heard, the vision statement that we have for the state police, our collaborative agreement, excuse me, and our code of ethics. Moving on to the next slide, you'll see at the top the Division of State Police currently has 109 policies and written directives. And those written directives are broken down into the following categories: the rules and regulations, which we just spoke about, general orders, which are essentially policies and professional standards that are put out, special orders, which are temporary orders, and that can be anything from a promotion or a transfer or a temporary modification to an existing order. And lastly, training bulletins, which are written directives that are essentially informational or instructional in nature. Just to give an idea, these policies cover a wide variety of topic areas, everything that we could possibly think about, from public relations to search and seizure, juvenile procedures to transporting prisoners to fingerprinting to sexual harassment to interview and interrogation. So it's a wide variety, again, of specific policies that are built off of our rules and regulations foundation set forth. Moving on to the next slide, which focuses on use of force policies. Our use of force policies include the topic areas such as our force continuum, that again comes right from PSTC, which includes police presence, verbal persuasion, use of empty hand control, physical strength, OC spray, use of taser, or use of impact weapons. It also covers unauthorized non-lethal weapons, medical assistance, reports and administrative reviews that need to take place, and lastly, RSA 627-5, justification for use in deadly force. Moving on to the next slide, titled Professional Standards Unit. Again, the New Hampshire State Police is very fortunate that we do have a professional standards unit, which is responsible for maintaining our professional standards of conduct manual for conducting administrative investigations regarding complaints, which are internal and external, and reviewing all incidents involving the use of force, pursuits, and cruiser accidents. This unit reports directly to me in my office, and it consists of three members. The unit member has the rank of lieutenant, and then there are two sergeant positions that are detectives, essentially detective sergeants. They also consult with my office regarding all personnel matters. And one thing they do, which is very similar to every other troop and unit that we have throughout the entire division as they complete an annual report. Moving on to the next slide, some of the software that we utilize through our professional standards unit are twofold. We have a program called IA Pro, which is essentially the case management software. It will track internal and external complaints. Internal complaints are initiated within the division, and external is comes from the general public. It can track use of force data, pursuit data, which could include both vehicle and vessel for our Marine Patrol officers, cruiser and vessel crash data, and lost or damaged property. The Blue Team program that we have is essentially issued division-wide, and that's the conduit software, which allows information to flow from the field into and out of IA Pro, where it is maintained. So essentially, the Blue Team program allows for any trooper that's involved in a cruiser accident to initiate that type of information in Blue Team, where it will travel through the respective chain of command and make its way to our professional standards unit and then make its way to my office for review. And the entire division contributes to that program. Moving on to the next slide, where you'll see software information and tracking. The review process for all use of force incidents, pursuits incidents, cruiser accidents, property damage, or lost property is completed within this system. Every incident is reviewed. And we do have the ability to track data by the individual incident, the individual police officer or trooper, the trooper unit where these incidents are occurring, the month of year in which they occur, or specifically by the type of force that are used. We can track all of this information. As we move forward, the Division of State Police in the Department of Safety has recently purchased a new records management system, which is in the process of getting up and running. We're anticipating a spring go-live time for that. And this new records management system is really going to allow us, one of the things it's going to allow us to do is to track a police officer or a trooper, really any employee, through the entirety of their career, from when they apply with the division all the way up until they retire, in many aspects of their career. They won't be able to do everything, and again, our professional standards unit will keep what's appropriate and specific to them separate. But right now, our recruitment and training unit does a fantastic job of tracking a lot of the training and tracking a number of things, but this system is going to be able to assist them to continue with that. Moving on to the next slide, you'll see policies at the top. We do have a comprehensive professional standards manual. Our focus as the Division of State Police is to focus on a number of things. Process improvement is number one. And, you know, you'll see on the side of the slide there, I note fair and impartial policing policy. You know, again, that is something we are very proud of. That is something we worked with Devin Chafee and her team at the ACLU on very collaboratively. It took about a year and a half to have the final product, but we are, again, proud of that. And working with the ACLU and the other partners, we feel we got it right. And we feel that it's an example of a good policy for others to emulate. That being said, we're always looking to improve. We're always looking for continuous process improvement. We look at current best practices, and that relates to training, equipment, and what acceptable standards are in any given area. The next bullet point is protocols. Any type of allegation or observation of any type of law enforcement misconduct, there are several avenues that we follow. If it's a violation of policy only, that is something we handle internally as a policy violation. If there is a criminal component, we then conform with the Attorney General's Public Integrity Protocol. If there's a civil rights violation, we can form the Attorney General's protocol on that as well. And if it's an issue, reference the exculpatory evidence schedule, also known as EES. We also conform with the Attorney General's protocol. So if there is a situation that is presented that we are either identify internally ourselves or comes in externally, we address that. If there are any questions at all as to anything, we confer with the Attorney General's office. Moving on to the next slide, it'll say future policy goals. Some goals that I've set forth for that unit specifically is to identify current acceptable and best policy practice. Again, we're an agency that is seeking continuous process improvement at all times. Two, to send our investigators in that unit to specialized training on a yearly basis. We have three individuals, as I mentioned, in that. And what that unit does is encompasses not only approximately 400 of our sworn personnel, but another 200 civilian personnel. So that unit works extremely hard to maintain our policies and main adherence to them on a daily basis. And assign personnel to address policy review and development on a more permanent basis. You know, right now we are undergoing a large policy review where we are looking at every policy we have. Some have been in the works for revamping for better parts of a year, and we want to continue to do that, and it's my goal to try to assign more personnel to do that. Moving on to the next slide, where it says summary at the top. Again, going back to the statement I believe I've made twice, it's our belief that healthy, well-trained police officer provide better services to our communities. Our future division goals, we will strive to be a forward-leaning and training-focused law enforcement agency in order to meet and exceed the changing needs of our communities. Some of the ways we can accomplish this are continuing our investment in de-escalation training, increasing division-wide implicit bias training, consulting with subject matter experts regarding use of force best practices, and there you'll see an asterisk. And I believe it was Attorney Jefferson who brought up the duty to intervene or choke holds and less deadly force, referenced the proposed change to law. We've already been thinking about that, and we've been thinking about that for a while, reference the choke holds. Maintaining current awareness of changing law, and maintaining transparency and accountability with the Attorney General's Office, Police Standards and Training Council, and others within the law enforcement community. And it's my belief, as important as policy is, culture is as important, if not more. And what is acceptable and what we're going to do to ensure accountability. Moving on to the last slide. I would just like to thank the Commission for taking on the responsibility of helping New Hampshire law enforcement with improving our ability to serve the communities where we live and where we work. We're open-minded and recognize the need for continuous process improvement in all aspects of our chosen profession, and we're certainly honored to be selected to take part in this process. One thing that I also have as this is the Commission on Law Enforcement Accountability, Community, and Transparency, I also have a very detailed community engagement presentation outlining the pride that we take in our engagement and involvement with the communities throughout the state. So if requested, I'm happy to provide information on that. I'd also add, New Hampshire's law enforcement is unique. We're unique, as Director Skipper pointed out. We all walk through the same door at the police academy, and we all walk out. We all contribute to our communities. We're in our schools. We coach sports. We are involved. Everyone knows where I live because they can see the cruiser in the driveway. We are unique in that we work where we live, and we're happy and certainly proud to do that. Maintaining a strong organizational culture, it starts with who we hire to wear this uniform that represents us, our officers, and our communities. We seek the best candidates that we can possibly get without compromising the standards that we set forth. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the presentation, that encompasses our very thorough vetting process. We want the best candidates that we can certainly get. I appreciate everyone's time. This is certainly an opportunity for everyone. And please know, if there's anything more that I can do or the New Hampshire State Police can do, we are committed to constant improvement. We're adaptable to the changing needs of our communities, and we certainly look forward to the recommendations put forth by all of the commission members through the general. So I would thank everybody for their time, and I'm happy to answer any questions, I think starting with Chief Edwards.
That's right. Thank you, Colonel. Chief, go ahead.
Thank you, General, and thank you, Colonel. And congratulations on your new position as Colonel.
Thank
and,
you, sir.
And I think we all feel very special to have such a wonderful state police organization, and your presentation was fantastic. So thank you for taking the time to put that together and sharing, giving us a better insight into the state police organization.
My pleasure, sir.
I just have a couple questions because I want to be brief because I want to make sure that everyone gets in today. First, I'm a big fan and a big supporter of national accreditation. And here in New Hampshire, I believe there are 15 accredited law enforcement agencies in New Hampshire and about five going through the accreditation process. And there are enormous benefits to the national accreditation process, some of which this commission is set up to review and make recommendations on. And those benefits are transparency, integrity, and accountability. Because of the national standards, they help agencies maintain compliance with national standards best practices. Can you tell us or share with the commission if the state police has ever pursued national accreditation or in the process of it or the challenges of the state police becoming a national accredited agency?
That's a great question, and I appreciate it, Chief. We are not currently CLIA certified, but I will say over the past few years, we have really devoted a lot of attention to our policies and looking at where we're going to go from here. It is a challenge for us, and I'm not going to sit here and say it's not. As I mentioned, we have 109 policies, but I can tell you we continually look at them. We continually look at best practices, and there are several ones that I've tiered into different priority levels what I've noticed in the past couple months that are on the verge of being able to put out. And I will say I'm very fortunate that this commission has been formed because I look forward to the recommendations as I put the finishing touches on those policies, sir.
Okay. Just one final question here. You mentioned a new system that the state police was acquiring or in the process of developing that tracks troopers from the beginning to the end of their career. And some agencies have what they call it early warning detection system where they can, certain indicators that an officer, he or she may be having troubles or struggling, you know, from report writing, calling in sick, use of force, display of tools on the tool belt too often, rough complaint. And when those are developed, there's an opportunity to bring the officer in to see if they need mental health assistance or training or counseling or retraining. Does the state police have such a policy? And if you do have such a policy, are you able to share that with the commission?
That's a good question, Chief. And I would have to research if we have a policy on that specifically, but we do have that capabilities through IA Pro and Blue Team. What I referenced earlier as far as the new system, it's an entire records management system, which is going to help us through documenting cases, through documenting statistics, and it has a personnel module that is going to be able to track an employee from start to finish. Anything related to what you just described, Chief, is we can already track in IA Pro and Blue Team, and our professional standards unit team keeps very close tabs on that. And if training pops up, we send them over to Lieutenant Davey, the commander of the recruitment and training unit. If it's a training issue, and if it's a policy issue, then we certainly handle that through our internal affairs process.
Thank you very much for your response. And again, thank you so much for the presentation. It was great.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chief. Ms. Chawla.
Thank you. My first question is, how much time is devoted to unconscious bias training and who does this training?
That's a great question. So we have our unconscious bias training is put in a number of different trainings throughout the year, whether that would be on our Moodle platform, when we're hired and they have to handle that three-week in-house academy with our professional standards unit through our Moodle, where they also review our fair and impartial policing policy. We've identified that we certainly are lacking in that area of unconscious bias training, and that is an area, I think, where I mentioned that we are taking immediate steps right now to bolster that type of training there.
Thank you. Can you submit for the record the current curriculum for this training?
I'm sorry, ma'am, but I think a noise walked over you. Can you repeat that?
Of course. I said, for the record, can you submit the current curriculum for this training?
I will certainly look into that and see exactly if we have a training curriculum for it or if it is going to be listed under our Moodle training. But, yes, I will get with recruitment and training.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
You were talking about policy goals that you have. Among these policy goals, why are none of these goals centered around race, especially considering the issues that we are charged with?
Whether you're not centered around what, ma'am? I'm sorry, you broke out.
Centered around race, considering the issues that we are charged with.
Well, that's a good question. I think as far as the policy reviews that we have, and I look at our fair and impartial policing policy, that is a policy that was put out in February of 2019. But if there is more specific policies that we should be looking at regarding race, I'm happy to listen to any recommendations the commission would make.
All right, thank you. My next question is, what data does the state police currently collect regarding the demographics of those stopped, detained, and arrested?
As far as we have a electronic ticket type application where information is entered on every motor vehicle stop, whether it's a warning or a ticket. So if a race is entered in that system, we can certainly track it through that system, and we've been using that system for a while.
So is there no data collected if these do not end in arrest or tickets or warnings?
If a license is scanned in and that information is readily available through the DMV, through the state the license is issued, it will be automatically captured. If that data has to be manually entered, ma'am, meaning the trooper is working offline or there's some difficulty and it has to be manually entered and it's not, that would be a circumstance where that would not be captured if it's not a mandatory field. And I apologize, I am not sure off the top of my head if that is a mandatory field.
Does this data include the demographic of race?
I believe it does, yes.
Okay, thank you. And does this data also include the reason for the stops and whether an officer asked for permission to conduct a search, what the basis of the search was, and whether contraband was found as a result?
So the first part of your question is yes, it does document the reason for the stop. It will document any type of motor vehicle violation that was identified in the stop, whether a summons or a warning was issued for the type of violation. And then we also have a separate policy. Whenever there is a search of a vehicle or a consent search is requested, that is documented separately. So it would be in the officer's notes in the ticket, but it would also be on a consent to search form that is maintained at each police station at each troop.
Thank you. And would you support making race a mandatory field to enter for this data?
I'm not prepared to answer that right at this moment, ma'am.
And I just believe that since we're talking about training, we need to be able to also answer whether or not that training has been effective, and race is a big part of that. But thank you for your answers.
Yes, ma'am.
That's all.
Thank you very much. Attorney Jefferson.
Yes, thank you, Attorney General. Colonel Noyes, how are you doing, sir?
I'm good, sir. How are you?
I am good. So I wanted to touch upon three things. So my first question to sort of guide our discussion is, does the New Hampshire State Police currently have an express duty to intervene policy that is individually acknowledged and signed by every trooper?
We do not, but I don't want to put words in Director Skipper's mouth, but I do believe I feel the same way as he does, that if a trooper or a police officer identifies any type of misconduct, they certainly have a duty as a person to intervene, for sure.
So I would ask, and I'm going to give you some brief commentary on why I think it is so important that in addition to it being signed individually by every cadet when they go through a police academy, that it's also, as soon as they get to their police agency, that it's important that it's signed again and that it is a law that is passed by the legislature. It is a statement that should be adopted by the chief of police because I think there is a real culture, especially with junior police officers, they are not going to feel that they have the power to interfere with another officer. And I think the death of George Floyd is a perfect example of that. I think it's important in any event just to say his name in this hearing because that's why I think we are all here. And in that circumstance, you had two junior officers that were just on their fourth shift, and you could tell that one of them tried to intervene by saying, roll him over, and that request was ignored. And my sister, who is a police officer, commented that she doesn't think that any officer, junior officer, especially somebody who's still in their probationary period, would feel empowered. So that's why I am advocating that I think it's so important that every opportunity we have available, that we are having officers sign on the dotted line to say this is our express policy as an individual organization or as a statewide academy. Is that something that makes sense to you, Colonel?
It does make sense, yes.
Okay. And equally important is an express duty to report misconduct by a fellow police officer. For all of the reasons that, we have previously discussed, there can be a culture in police agencies that have an immense pressure not to, quote-unquote, dime out or rat out a fellow police officer. And the only way to sort of tear down that culture is to reinforce a police officer's overriding duty to protect the public and not fellow police officers when they see misconduct. So same question to you. Do you feel it would make sense that at every single opportunity that individual agencies as well as statewide training academies have cadets and officers sign on the dotted line to say you have an express duty to report misconduct that you view by fellow police officers?
I wouldn't object to signing on the dotted line. I can tell you that I believe that there's certainly a culture in this organization. I believe there's a culture in every organization throughout this state that you are responsible and held accountable for your actions. And I can tell you that I certainly would never want to jeopardize my career over the actions of somebody else, if that makes sense.
No, that makes sense. And I understand, being personally held responsible for your individual actions, but it is another thing to say that you have an equal responsibility to actively report misconduct that you witness or you are made privy to by fellow police officers. And I think that's a separate conversation where there's certainly a need to create a culture to make sure that that is known, that that is a top priority in our police agencies. Is that something that makes sense to you?
It is. And I'll tell you, I'm going through some papers here. I can't speak 100% sure, but I believe we have that in our policy already. So if that helps.
Yes. But to the extent it doesn't exist in other agencies, or do you think it makes sense to include that anywhere and everywhere we can?
Yeah. Yes, I would.
My last question to you is, does New Hampshire State Police currently have an express policy banning chokeholds, strangleholds, and placing people in a prone position and restrained?
It does not, and I believe it's to We don't teach that. It's not taught at the police academy. A chokehold is not an approved technique. We certainly don't teach it through our defensive tactics instructors, so it's not something we train in or necessarily train against, but we do not have a policy. Your answer, the answer to your question, sir, is no.
Would you support changing that? Do you think it makes sense to have that changed? And, you know, we have George Floyd's example. I think I imagine you might also be aware of the man in Tucson, Arizona, that was restrained on a floor for 12 minutes that led to his death. So we know that these things can be dangerous. So, you know, it's one thing not to train on them, but I think it's equally important to expressly prohibit them. Does that make sense? And that, would that be something that you support?
Yes, and it would be something I support. I think you were the one, Attorney Jefferson, yesterday who articulated, you know, unless a deadly force type situation, I think we need to keep in mind that police officers are making very quick decisions based on rapidly changing situations where the decision they make is going to have long-lasting results on themselves and everyone else involved. So I think you were the one that articulated it yesterday regarding a deadly force stipulation, I believe.
Yes, yes. No, and I wholeheartedly agree with you. You know, once justified objectively, a police officer can use justified deadly force, then, you know, then this policy would no longer be applicable. So I want to end on something, and I was very encouraged that you said this, was that beyond policies, it is more the culture of police agencies that are going to drive the day. So I want to end by asking you this, because I agree with you. I think that policies can lead to affecting police culture, but at the end of the day, you know, a police culture is going to override any policy. And so do you think that it's important for police agencies in this state to actively guard against allowing a culture in policing that can lead to an us versus them mentality, you know, a mentality that can lead to bullying and racism in our community? Do you think it's important for police agents to actively guard against that culture infiltrating?
Absolutely.
And what do you think could be done about that from a policy and training perspective?
Well, that's a good question, because as I mentioned before, policy is extremely important, but culture is more so. That is the acceptable practice at all times, even when no one is looking. It's the difference between discipline and self-discipline. I'm very disciplined when my boss is watching me, but when no one's watching me, do I have the courage or the, you know, intestinal fortitude to continue to do the right thing? So I'll tell you, Attorney Jefferson, I don't think I have a specific answer on how that takes place, other than, you know, it takes time to build a very healthy, proactive culture, and I feel that certainly my agency, my predecessors have been successful at doing that here.
Thank you very much, Colonel, for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lutz-Goss.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Colonel Noyes, for this presentation that you made today, and for answering these questions, and for highlighting the collaboration you're doing with the ACLU New Hampshire on seeking effective police reforms. My first question to you, at the beginning of your presentation, you had mentioned the number of stops that the state police make per year. What was that number again?
That number was approximately 123,000 stops, traffic stops a year.
Oh, wow. Okay. So I'm wondering, are state police trained to use motor vehicle stops as pretextual reasons for investigating non-motor vehicle-related issues?
No.
Okay. So are they specifically trained not to conduct such pretextual stops based on race?
Yes, and that is in our fair and impartial policing policy.
Okay. And the only reason why I ask this is we were speaking with a New Hampshire attorney who practices here, and the attorney was recalling a case involving her client where her client was pulled over and the state trooper entered into his report that part of his suspicion of pulling the driver over was the fact that the driver was speaking Spanish. And so in that sense, it seems as if that would be based on race. So what would be the consequences of police conducting stops in violation of this policy?
I'm not sure of the incident you're referring to. It's the first time I've heard of that. But they would be in violation of a division policy. And again, it would go to not only if they were violating policy, but my office or the Division of State Police would also look into if it is going to be a civil rights type violation or any violation, whether it's a criminal component or civil rights violation, that we would refer to the Attorney General's office based on their protocol. So it has the potential to be handled both internally with the division and then through the AG's office, if that makes sense.
Okay, great. And again, I think that with this amount of stops and if allegations like this are happening, I just want to note that this is why the ACLU of New Hampshire strongly supports Commissioner Rennell's suggestion that race be a field that's required to record false stops and arrests, because this data is crucial if we're going to assess how people of color are policed here in our state. I want to shift gears going over to the fair and impartial training that you spoke about, because I believe that you said that it was on a Noodle, it's part of a Noodle, which is an online course, right?
It is it's called Moodle, and it is it's an internet-based, training tracking system.
Okay. Now, how would you evaluate compliance on a participant's part when it comes to fair and impartial policing policies when they're taking that? In the sense that this is not something that can be forced. In order for this information to really take effect, it has to be absorbed and willing on the participant's part. So how do you evaluate that compliance on this?
That's a great question. So specifically for the fair and impartial policing in Moodle, there are a number of questions that have to be answered, and we have some aspects of training that we put through Moodle that is maybe a pass-fail. As it relates to fair and impartial policing, the trooper must score 100% in order to pass this policy. And they're asked a number of different specific questions. So they have to score 100.
All right. Thank you very much, Colonel. I appreciate that. And I'm done.
Thank you very much, Mr. Norton.
Thank you, and it was an excellent presentation, Colonel, and thank you for your service. Can you, as a follow-up to the previous question from Chief Edwards about accreditation, what training or resources would be needed for state police to apply for accreditation through KALA or another organization?
That's a great question, Director Norton. And I think right now, to be completely direct, I would need to find the personnel and devote the time based on 3 full-time police officers, a lieutenant, and 2 sergeants with over 109 policies, many of which are in review now with that unit, myself, and the legal department. So it would essentially be time-dedicated resource deployment in that area, sir.
Thanks. And can you say a little bit more about the training that occurs at New Hampshire Hospital and how that's unique and why the department decided to do that additional training?
Absolutely. And thank you for bringing that up. So what we do when a trooper or a new officer is hired, they have to spend a day, a full shift, and it may even be 2 at this point. We may have upped it over at the New Hampshire Hospital just to deal with the types of circumstances that present themselves over in that facility, to make our troopers aware of how to handle and cope with that, to not the first time we want our police officers and troopers running into a situation like that is certainly not at a call for service. where they're possibly by themselves out on the streets. So we try to do it in a somewhat controlled environment where they are exposed to different types of behavior, and they are provided the resources with how to cope with that and how to handle those types of situations. It's been extremely beneficial for our development as individuals in an organization, and we've received some very positive feedback as the results.
Great. Thanks for that. And how many hours does state police require for troopers to get recertified? Is it the same 8 hours that Director Skipa talked about yesterday, or does state police internally require more than that?
So our certification hours all come through PSTC. So anything that the state police does, we certainly meet those standards set forth by the council. And then as an organization, as many other organizations do, we identify different areas, as many as we can, where we seek to exceed them. So we are exceeding those hours as an individual organization.
Great. And a follow-up to Attorney Jefferson's question, what training do troopers receive regarding intervening when they see misconduct? And what are the consequences if they fail to report it?
That's a great question, sir. We don't have any specific training that we put on regarding intervention. That being said, if there is type of misconduct, they could and would likely, if there were misconduct taking place, violate an internal policy and or criminal law. So any type of incident where there's any type of misconduct that is alleged through either observation or through the information making it to a supervisor or a trooper's ears, that'll be looked at both internally with the division and through the Attorney General's office.
Thanks. And then, you know, related to that, regarding professional standards, what threshold needs to be met for an internal investigation or an external complaint to be forwarded to police standards and training?
For police standards and for it to be forwarded to police standards and training?
Yeah.
So it would have to meet different protocols or requirements, whether it is a alleged violation of a crime that took place. We then adhere to the Attorney General's protocol. And I think certain forms were talked about yesterday, whether they are sent to Director Skipa and his team in conjunction with the Attorney General's office. We also have to follow a variety of personnel rules, sir, within the Department of Safety and our policies through HR. So they could possibly be suspended, our trooper could be suspended with pay or without pay, depending on the type of allegation and the information that we have, if that helps.
Yeah, thanks. And then my final question, if there is that type of investigation, and let's say the trooper is suspended or not suspended, but the investigation is going on, and they choose to resign or retire, does that internal investigation continue to completion, or does it stop if they leave service?
That investigation will continue to completion, whether they are still employed or not.
Great. Thanks. Thanks so much, Colonel.
And thank you, sir.
Done.
Thank you. Chief Dennis.
No questions from me, sir.
Thank you, Lieutenant Morrison.
Good afternoon, Colonel. Thank you for your presentation. I have one brief question I would just like to clarify. Going through your comprehensive presentation, after you spoke of your IA Pro software, is the Blue Team software the same software you mentioned for the new records management system that you're going to be using?
No, sir, it's not. The Blue Team is specific to internal processes versus, you know, with type of use of force, pursuits, that type of data that professional standards handles. our records management system is the new one is going to be in conjunction with dispatch. So it's essentially an all-encompassing records management system that our organization has. It just has a personnel type module that is going to assist recruitment and training with tracking the careers of our employees.
What is the name of that software, if you don't mind, Colonel?
The company is CSI, it's Computer Squared Incorporated, and they are out of New Jersey.
Okay, thank you very much.
It's going to be Info Module or InfoShare is their main product.
Okay,
thank you,
Judge.
Thank you, Lieutenant. Judge Gardner.
Good afternoon. Colonel Noyes, thank you very much for your detailed presentation. I have a question that's related to the importance of culture, which I think a lot of people have talked about. And you also spoke about culture in the context of starting with who you hire and hiring the best candidates. So my question is, do you have any guidance or recommendations for the commission on how police departments can better vet candidates, establish a recruitment process, and perhaps also, I don't know if you have sort of a guideline as to background investigations related specifically to assessing any bias in potential candidates. So that's my question. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for the question. You know, I don't know if I would have any specific advice for the commission. Recruiting for law enforcement is a challenge. It's a challenge with many different aspects of policing in today's world. And as a law enforcement leader and a leader of the New Hampshire State Police, I am seeking the best candidates that we possibly can, and we are really using every avenue possible to identify those candidates. And in doing so, we are broadening our community base, and we are getting out into more areas the most we can. And we're looking for candidates that are really going to choose this profession as a calling, and that's difficult to identify, and we're going to do so without changing our standards. However, we are constantly looking at our standards to see if they're appropriate. So we are looking to adapt to the changing needs, you know, of our communities and what policing is today. And so as far as any specific recommendations to the commission, I don't. But I believe that, you know, culture takes years and decades to build along with trust. And we just have to keep working at it. And I apologize, Judge, I forgot the second part of your question, ma'am.
Sorry, I think it was sort of a dual question. I think it was sort of the background investigation. I don't know if you have specific guidelines that you follow to sort of weed out candidates that may be disqualified because of any bias they may have.
No, that's a great question. So, again, going through our comprehensive hiring process, we have the background where any police agency or most police agencies in the state are doing their best to do a very thorough background. You throw in that, you throw in references, you throw in, you know, researching the path that this candidate has taken to get to where they are and are seated in front of you at that moment, and you look at the legacy or the reputation that they have. We also utilize the other tools. You know, we utilize the polygraph that we have. That right there in the pre-polygraph interview, that really separates some of the candidates to the extent that we actually have moved that up in our process, as has many other agencies, to where it's actually before the background investigation, because we were investing a lot of time and resources in conducting thorough backgrounds only to get to the polygraph examination and to have the candidate not be viable. So we've taken internal strides to streamline and create better efficiency in our system where we are able to identify any biases that may come up.
Thank you for your answer. I have no other questions.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. McKim.
Thank you, General, and thank you, Colonel Norris, for your testimony and your service. Great presentation. So my first question, I wonder if I could pick up on the thread that Judge Garner was just describing and asking about. And you mentioned that part of the testing that goes on when you're bringing someone in is implicit bias testing. Did I hear that correctly?
Well, no, sir. I don't think I said that specifically, Mr. McKim, but along those lines are when we are looking at a potential trooper candidate and we're going through whether it's an oral board examination or a polygraph examination or a detailed background investigation, we are looking to identify, and of course the psychological examination, we're looking to identify areas of concern. All-encompassing areas of concern, if that makes sense.
Okay, so no implicit bias testing is done at that point, it sounds like.
Not that I'm aware of, sir, not to my specific knowledge.
Okay, and to follow the thread a little bit further, is there any implicit bias testing done at all that might lead to potential debiasing training?
Not specifically that I'm aware of at this moment, Mr. McKim.
Okay, great. Thank you. My next question is just to clarify a little bit. I think you mentioned that there is a quarterly training that is done.
That's correct. For our organization, use of force is trained quarterly, whether that is in defensive tactics, daytime and nighttime firearms training, and summer simunitions scenario-based training. So that is the quarterly type of training I was referring to for state police specifically.
Okay, great. Thank you. So one of the things I was struggling with is there's a lot of great training there that's happening. It seems like at some point there's like a 2016 and 2018 kind of event that was training. I'm trying to get a sense of is there a consistent set of training that happens on a regular basis, like this quarterly kind of training you just mentioned?
There is not.
Okay. Right. Thank you. My next question is kind of a pickup on something Mr. Norton asked about in terms of grant funding. I was noticing that the CIT training, for example, is listed as grant funded. And I'm just curious, is there any danger in that not being funded in the future or other training that happens through grants? What's your sense of the funding support that you get for the training that you do?
That's a good question, and I don't specifically have an answer for you. I don't know what type of grants are going to be available for different types of training, but what we do as an organization is we pay very close attention to that, and then when something opens up, we try to maximize our opportunity of getting that grant or getting that training. So we will essentially put a number of resources forward to identify what it is and to put our best foot forward to be given that grant, if that makes sense.
Okay, sure. Like any other organization, pretty much.
Yes. Yes, sir.
Great, thank you. So my next question is, I'm just curious about that resiliency and wellness training. I really like that that's there and really glad that you were able to get folks through that you got through. I'm curious what's preventing you from getting 100% of the troopers through that training.
Yeah, are you referring to Breach Point, in 2018, resiliency and wellness?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Based on that number, again, and I can't speak specifically, but I would say my guess is some of them were on vacation. You know, some of them were unavailable out of state for training. But I remember at the time under Colonel Wagner that that we sent, you know, 270 troopers, but that also there were also other parts of the Department of Safety. I believe Commissioner Quinn attended it, and he wasn't a sworn member at the time. So we certainly make a concerted effort with an order that is put out that everyone will attend it. So if someone did not attend it, they certainly had a valid reason not to, if that makes sense.
All right. So is this resiliency and wellness kind of training, is that done on a regular basis? I imagine it might be part of the peer unit efforts, but just want to be sure there's an emphasis on that concept of resiliency and wellness that's taught on a regular basis.
Yeah, and that's a great question. And I think, you know, well, what we have done is by creating the mental health and wellness coordinator position with Russ Conti is we've really invested in our peer unit, and our peer unit is able to assist throughout the entire division. So while there's not specific training that is put out on an annual basis for resiliency and wellness training, we now are fortunate to have a foundation in this organization where those resources are available at any time. The vast majority of this organization can identify early warning signs. Anyone can make an anonymous call to any member of the peer unit to have someone checked in. So again, getting back to, you know, almost Judge Gardner's comment about culture, that was our goal, create a culture here where it's acceptable to essentially ask for help.
Okay, great. Thank you. If I could next pick up on a question that Ms. Diella asked, just referring to the IA Pro software and the software that tracks the arrests and behavior of officers. Can you tell me anything about the training that the folks who are analyzing the data get? I'm particularly wondering about analysis of that data with a diversity lens to it.
That's a great question, and I can't speak specifically as to the training that the members of that unit have regarding IA Pro. As far as Blue Team goes, everyone is trained, every officer and trooper within this organization is trained in Blue Team and how to complete the requirements within that system, how to submit it, and how to send it through the chain of command. I do know the lieutenant in our professional standards unit, along with the two sergeants, have the ability to search at any time with any of the given criteria that they can search for anything at any time. But as far as the specific training that they receive, whether it's consistent or just one time only, I apologize. I'm unfamiliar, but I can get you an answer.
Okay, great. That'd be helpful to see what that training is about.
Yes, sir.
My next question, and I really appreciate the professional standards manual work and the work with the ACLU to bring that about. You mentioned that there is a policy review team in place to review the policies in that manual. I'm just curious to know if the ACLU is working on that or if there's a public and diversity lens to that review that's going on?
That's a great question. There is currently not. And, you know, as I was preparing for this presentation, I found it very beneficial that this commission had been put together because I'm very much looking forward to the recommendations that come out of the commission as I look to finalize those types of policies based on the input from all the commission members.
Okay, great. Thank you. My last question, going back to the accreditation question that I think Chief Edwards and Mr. Norton may have touched upon, and you mentioned some of what you thought was going to be necessary to apply for accreditation. Is there a way that we could be provided with some of that detail in terms of cost and what it would take? I'd like to see if that's something we can build into our recommendation.
Mr. McKim, it's Bob Quinn. Can you hear me all right, James?
Yes, I can.
Sure. Yeah, thank you. Just to kind of give a little history to this, the division had embarked on that goal several years ago, and we found that it was just very challenging, and with full transparency, we just didn't get it done. Over the last several years, we have been through a project of updating all of our policies, working with a vendor, an outside contractor, to strive to getting all of these policies CALEA compliant, the gold standard, as you know, Chief Edwards duly noted. It's been a challenge. Many of them have been completed. Some are in draft form. Over the last several months, we've been diverted on COVID, but it does still stand as a goal. The Colonel is looking at each one of these. And as you can imagine, with 109 policies, there are some that are, you know, more benign than others. But, my hat's off to any organizations that have achieved that. And we want to continue to strive for that goal. And, again, we've got all of our policies. Some have been completed. And I can't speak there are some challenges with our agency being compliant, you know, due to how we're, we have seven, troop stations. We've got different venues for storing evidence and things of that nature. But, any help in achieving that goal would be greatly appreciated.
Great, thank you. So I guess that's the gist of my question. Help us to understand what we can do to help you.
Yes, sir. We certainly will.
Okay, thank you, Mr. McKim. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Attorney General. The questions that Chief Edwards had asked based on accreditation were basically the foundation of the questions I asked yesterday. So I can say asked and answered. I'm pretty satisfied with the information I have, so I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Director Skipa.
Thank you, General. Colonel, thank you very much for that excellent presentation. The question I had was relative to your RMS system, CSI InfoShare. I'd like to just talk with you offline on that, because I think it's something that we could use here to maybe track every police officer in the state of New Hampshire, and that's something that we're looking at now. Other than that, I just want to congratulate you on your recent appointment. It is my belief that your organization is going to be both benefiting and growing under your leadership, and I really look forward to working with you to move New Hampshire law enforcement in a positive way. Thank you.
Thank you, Director, and I'll reach out to you offline about that that vendor.
Thank you, Director Malachi.
Yes, good afternoon. And thank you, Colonel Noyes, for the presentation. And I didn't have an opportunity, or I didn't take the opportunity, to thank Director Skipper yesterday for his, so thank you as well. I just have a couple of questions, and one of which is as it relates to candidates. And if you could briefly explain, so if you had, for example, 100 people that decided, today I want to apply to become a trooper, and you have 100 candidates apply. As they go through the process, is there an average number that you might end up with? I mean, do you customarily end up with, 90% of that number as it pertains to recruiting and getting people through the entire process?
That's a great question, and I can't speak for other agencies, but as far as, this New Hampshire State Police goes, if we have 80 to 100 candidates sign up to take the physical agility testing and the written testing, what we do as an organization is our recruitment and training unit continually will reach out to those candidates, phone calls and emails, in order to demonstrate that we want them. We want them to come to this organization, to be a part of this, and to encourage the fact that we're involved. depending on who shows up, maybe two-thirds of them will show up for the actual test. But we try to get confirmations ahead of time to see what the specific numbers are. We will lose some, very small percentage, in the physical agility testing. Very minimal, if any, in the written testing. Most of our candidates will pass the written. And then we get to the oral board, where, again, we don't lose too many, but we do lose some. Then we get to the polygraph. That is where we see the numbers start to dwindle down. So after the polygraph, when you get to the background investigation, then the psychological, and then the interview in my office, you know, most recently, if we had 65 or 70 signed up, I don't know the specific numbers. I'd have to check with Lieutenant Davey. But the specific numbers that we have signed up, we hired three. We hired three. And again, that is not just like every other law enforcement agency in the state, not compromising our standards, but constantly reviewing to see if the standards are appropriate. And based on what I saw in this most recent, I felt that they were appropriate.
Okay. And then as a part of the background test checks and combing over all of the information, I know several of the other commission members talked about ascertaining any sorts of bias or anything. In the background check, is there anything that may come up, since there's not so much a test when you first start? But is there anything in the investigative process on the potential applicants that would bring to light any sort of bias?
That's a great question, and I think most of it would come from the interviews that take place, either from coworkers, from family members, from friends of friends. So when a background investigation is conducted, you know, we don't necessarily just talk to the applicant or the references that are put down that the applicant would like us to talk to, but we dig a little deeper into their background. You know, in addition, a lot of the pre-polygraph questioning really gets to the specifics. So if someone is trying to hide something, that's going to come out during that questioning, and then it's certainly going to come out during the actual test itself, if that helps.
Yes, it does. And then certainly there's training, and so you can ascertain if there are other issues as people are progressing, once they've been hired, if they're continuing to progress through the training that's required. You'd be able to pick up on something and then address that.
Yes, ma'am. So, you know, they'd head over to Director Skipper's team, and then, you know, they're certainly under a microscope over there with everything that they do, having the tests that they have to pass, the certifications they have to obtain, and the standards they have to meet. And then when they come out of the academy, as I mentioned, they're put into a field training and evaluation program where there's an evaluation done on them every single day. So in addition to the training that they have to pass with us, the specific training or the general training, throughout that 65 days, they are essentially reviewed every single day in an official document until they demonstrate consistently that they can meet the standards.
Understood. And this may be sort of an odd question, but because of some of the concerns that have been voiced by some of the other members on the commission, I just thought this could be an appropriate question to ask. Is there any sort of training or conversations that are given, that are held with higher-ranking members of the state police to potentially work with attorneys to make sure that if an attorney has a concern about treatment of a client or a grievance, that the attorney feels comfortable with making those reports or statements, or making sure that it's documented so that they don't leave and are unable to handle any needs of their client, but it's certainly been made a part of the record, so to speak, for anyone that's detained or arrested or anything so that it can, if it's an issue based on any discriminatory factors, it could certainly be looked into, or if it was appropriate behavior, then that could be handled, and then the attorney would know so that both parts are working together, so that state police higher-ups know that, okay, this could be an issue, so we need to address this for the rank and file in training so that it's handled better. Or if it's not an issue, then it's handled so that the attorney knows, okay, I've made a report, I've done my due diligence, I've spoken up for my client, and this has gone on record.
That's a great question, and the short answer is no, there's nothing formal. However, law enforcement, working with all of our partners, whether they're other law enforcement agencies, community members, members of the Defense Council, it's about building relationships, and troopers throughout the state, a lot of them prosecute their own cases, especially in the northern part of the state where they do have their relationship with different attorneys. Down south is not so much, but what we do have is we have prosecutors that look to build those relationships. And I will tell you, our prosecutors keep a close eye on these types of cases, and they build the relationships with members of the defense bar. In addition, a trooper's supervisor, you know, we shift bid, for example, every 4 months. Any report that is submitted in that shift bid or that four-month period goes to a specific supervisor for review. So for the length of someone's career, they're not going to have the same supervisor, if that makes sense. It's very likely could change up to 3 or 4 times any given year, depending. So as reports are turned in and maybe similar information is gleaned from a supervisor reviewing it or a prosecutor reviewing the cases and they see some type of systemic problem, that's immediately brought to a supervisor's attention, and that's immediately passed up the chain to see what type of review, if not modification or remedial training, needs to be done, if not more, if that helps.
Yes, it does. And thank you very much. I have one last question, and then I'm done. I know there's been a lot of questions regarding different types of use of force policies, and we've specifically spoken about chokeholds, and there's some other things that have been mentioned over the last two sessions. And I guess my question would be, if it's something that the state police, and according to Director Skipper's presentation yesterday, if it's something that people are not, law enforcement representatives are not trained in, and it is not something that's done, is it beneficial to create a policy that says we don't ever do this if it's something we don't do? And then to put apples with apples, the other part of the question would be, are there other things that you don't do that you have policies stating that you don't do them, meaning express policies like we're discussing with chokeholds, et cetera?
That's a great question, and I'm trying to think off of the top of my head to answer the second part of your question, that we specifically don't do something. And there is, and I can think of one thing off the top of my head. I think, and that doesn't pertain to use of force, though. So to answer the use of force question, I think it is challenging to identify every circumstance where a police officer is to do something specific regarding use of force based on the rapidly changing circumstances presented in front of them. That's not to say that I certainly go back to the statement I made earlier, which was very similar to Director Skipper's as far as the chokehold and how to articulate that. I think it's challenging to say that we're going to prevent any given tactic or personal belief of something that's necessary in every given situation, if that makes sense. I'm certainly not trying to avoid answering the question. I'm just not sure how to be specific about it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that does. And I think that was the answer that I was. I think you answered the question. For me, I just want to make sure as we as a collective are coming together and creating the guidelines that we don't create something that doesn't work for how law enforcement needs to work. You know, there certainly needs to be thought put into what we're doing as a collective and then how it will affect law enforcement and how law enforcement does their work within the community. But I just wanted to make sure, and that answered my question. So I thank you for that.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
And Ms. Malachi, it's Bob Quinn. If I can just add one thing, if you have a minute.
Sure.
Ma'am, I believe that both you, yourself, and two of the other commission members, I believe Judge Gardner, brought up bias and background investigations. And I just want to add that these background investigations, the Colonel is always adapting and changing what questions are asked. As he laid out, there's different layers of them. But clearly, I think there's opportunities moving forward to address and to identify if there are any issues of bias. Do our candidates understand what implicit or explicit bias is? We also have made very great strides with our psychological testing and the questions that are asked there. So I think for the group, there are opportunities in our to enhance our background to identify that any issues at the onset. I just wanted to share that. The other thing I wanted to add is there is also an extensive review of social media to ensure or identify anything that would raise a flag. But I think these psychologicals have been quite useful, and we've seen them improve over the years in our decision-making process.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for that additional information, Commissioner Quinn. And I am all finished, Attorney General Gordon McDonald.
Thank you very much. Commissioner Quinn, do you have any questions for Colonel Noyes?
No, sir.
Colonel, I want to thank you for your testimony. And we do need to move on, so I will defer what questions I had. But on several occasions, you mentioned it, and it's come up during our discussion, was reference to the fair and impartial policing policy. And I would like you to produce that to the commission so we can make it as part of the record.
Yes, sir, I certainly will.
I note that under the leadership of our colleague, Mr. Johnson, the Governor's Advisory Council on Diversity and Inclusion pointed to that policy as a model that might be used by other law enforcement agencies in our state, and this perhaps is an unfair question, but do you have any sense as to whether other law enforcement agencies have reached out for it and are using it?
They have reached out, and anyone that has received a copy of it.
Okay. Well, again, thank you. Great testimony and very, very helpful questions and back and forth. Thank you very much, Colonel.
Thank you, General. And if it's okay with the commission, do I have permission to be excused from the rest of the hearing?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Next, we're going to hear from our colleague, Chief Charlie Dennis. Chief Dennis is the chief of the Hanover Police Department. And for this year, he's serving as the president of the New Hampshire Association of Chiefs of Police. Again, referring to our charge, we are to inquire into training, curriculum, policies, and procedures developed by local police departments. And I think the chief can give us at least some insight about what is going on in the 200-plus local police agencies we have in our state. So, Chief, the floor is yours.
Thank you, General. And just before I start into my presentation, just to follow up on the fair and impartial policing policy that you just mentioned that state police created, it is a model policy. We've had training at the Chiefs Association by attorney coming in and talking about that policy, making it available to our membership, and that it is a great policy to have in place. So that information is out there on that policy. So
thank you. And before you begin, Chief, I do, for members of the public, you have submitted written testimony. It is, again, available on the Commission's website. So go ahead, Chief.
Thank you, General. And I'm going to be reading from what was presented that the public and the other commissioners have. I'll be ad-libbing and adding a little bit to it as I go along, as I've had another day to think about things. and also listening to testimony and questions coming from fellow commission members. But I've been asked to make this presentation as a representative of the New Hampshire Association of Chiefs of Police, addressing the following two areas of training and policies and procedures. Director Skip has done an excellent job talking about training around the state, especially starting at the academy level. Colonel Noyce has done an excellent job talking about what the state police do. They have powers that are statewide where they provide law enforcement services and the type of training and policies and procedures they have in place. Being the representative of the New Hampshire Association of Chiefs of Police, we have over 200 law enforcement agencies in the state, and everyone does it a little bit different. And so I'm going to be providing a kind of a broad overview for the public and the other commission members of kind of how it works once you graduate the academy. And then once I get done, I'll be happy to answer any questions. The basic police academy is just that. It's entry-level training. Once a recruit successfully completes and passes the classes, hands-on training, and testing, they become certified as a law enforcement officer in New Hampshire and have to annually complete 8 hours of refresher trainings exclusive of firearms, first aid, or defensive tactics. In addition to the annual firearms range time, officers are required to attend refresher trainings of not less than 4 hours regarding the use of deadly and non-deadly force. That totals 12 hours that are required annually by Police Standards and Training Council to maintain an officer's certification. Once an officer becomes certified, there is no standard requirement for specific training except firearms and use of force mentioned previously. It is left to the individual department to determine what training officers receive, and that can vary widely from department to department. The basic academy training forms a foundation for each individual department to then build upon. Many, but not all departments, then begin a formalized field training officer, or the acronym is FTO, program upon graduation, which would be considered a best practice. These programs vary in length, depth, and requirements. Most departments are in the 10 to 12 week range, some are less, but for an example of variance, Bedford does a 20 week program. During an FTO program, a new officer is assigned and works alongside another officer who generally has received specialized training to be an FTO. Daily observation reports are completed to assist and ensure the officer is progressing through the program, and some departments may do additional testing over materials and procedures. The officer generally will rotate through different FTOs, depending on the size of the agency, work different shifts, and would assume greater responsibilities through each phase of the program. Once an officer successfully completes their FTO program, they become a solo officer, one who can fully execute the duties and responsibilities of the position by themselves. Besides the annual requirements set forth by PSTC, each individual agency, generally the chief, determines what trainings are important to the mission and goals of the department. Officers routinely submit training requests to their supervisors for trainings that they are interested in or desire to specialize in a specific area. There are other areas that determine trainings within a department and may be based on the need for refresher trainings in specific areas, legislative changes or mandates, promotions requiring supervisory trainings, specialized assignments such as a detective, DWI enforcement, narcotics, canine, a prosecutor, and accident reconstruction, just to name a few. There are hundreds of trainers and trainings available for law enforcement across the U.S. As in any profession, the quality of trainers and trainings vary, with some being better than others, and the cost of such trainings vary considerably too. There are several factors that can determine the training or amount of trainings an officer receives each year. Factors include the cost of the training, lodging and travel expenses, overtime related to the officer being on their days off, or overtime associated with backfilling their position, or the amount of training funds available in a department's budget. Many times a department's training budget is one of the first areas to be cut during a budget process, as some look at only trying to meet the minimum standards as required by PSTC, as described earlier. Most of the departments in New Hampshire are small, but there are a few large departments, with Manchester and Nashua being the two largest. Both of those agencies have a robust training program and training in addition to the current 16-week PSTC Academy and standard 12-week FTO program. For example, Manchester PD does 6 weeks before the recruit goes to the Academy and 2 weeks after the Academy, for a total of 8 additional weeks of training on a variety of topics that they feel is necessary for their new officers to receive. The Chiefs Association knows that training is a key component to helping officers be successful in their duties each day and to best serve our communities. I've had the opportunity to speak with Director Skip on several occasions, and I know we're in agreement on many fronts on how to progress 21st century policing training in New Hampshire. Training that covers the most important elements of the 6 pillars of 21st century policing is essential as we move forward. Some of the recommendations we are looking to in that area of training would be annual implicit and explicit bias training and cultural diversity training that is required to obtain and maintain state certification. Director Skip is already talking about looking at new curriculum, which he mentioned yesterday. I've had the opportunity to review the, I think it's a 2-day class. Was very impressed with the curriculum he's looking at bringing in. Definitely hits the nail on the head, talking about implicit and explicit bias training. Talks about procedural justice and police legitimacy. So I'm looking forward as this goes on of the new training they may be bringing in. Also, annual de-escalation training to maintain certification. You heard Director Skipa yesterday talk about the ICAT training that was recommended through PERF that deals with de-escalation and communication. That's something Chiefs Association has talked about a couple years ago. It's been expensive as we look to see is that something that we could bring to our state. But again, there's always a cost associated with that. You heard Director Skip also mention CIT training that deals with working with individuals experiencing mental health issues, and also one that the Chiefs Association would feel would be important for our state. Annual wellness and resiliency training. You certainly heard Colonel Noyes spoke about that and the importance of that. I think James McKim also talked about that. You know, it is important. A lot of what law enforcement deals with, many times when we get a call for a service, people are not having a good day, whether it's a domestic violence call, whether someone broke into their house, whether a loved one's passed away, whether someone's got pulled over by a motor vehicle stop. Many of our interactions or not when the public is at their best because of the circumstances, the crisis that they may be dealing with. And that's stressful for law enforcement. So to help us be better and always on our best game, it's important for us to have that wellness and resiliency training to help us be better. Use of force training guidelines by PSTC that requires annual qualification to maintain certification with specific prohibitions against specific restraints, including but not limited to chokehold or carotid restraint holds. Director Skip already spoke to the 30 guiding principles on the use of force. Certainly consistency in policy and training is important. You've heard Chief Edwards mention that also. You know, Commissioner Jefferson mentioned the duty to intervene. And Director Skip mentioned yesterday the EPIC training, the ethical policing is courageous, which is where you're actually training the officers about that duty to intervene and going through scenarios. It's not just someone sitting up and reading you lines from a curriculum script. You're actually interacting and going through scenarios so that when it comes to a real-life situation, you can react properly. Creation of a New Hampshire model of standards of conduct, which is reviewed on an annual basis with officers, and they certify understanding of these standards. Most departments have standards of conduct, but creating a state model would ensure that all departments operate under the same basic expectations. Departments could always go above and beyond with additional requirements. Creation of additional core curriculum requirement that builds upon the basic academy requirement. These core classes would be taken at specific annual intervals from years 1 to 5, for example, and be tied to maintaining certification or obtaining a higher level of certification. And an example I'd give you is currently the police academy is 16 weeks long. Generally speaking, you're bringing in a recruit that has no experience in law enforcement. It may have been what they observed on TV. Maybe they have a loved one that's been in law enforcement, or it's just something they think they have a passion to want to do. So they come in with no experience. In the 16 weeks, besides learning motor vehicle laws, all the RSAs, the criminal codes, both those books well over a couple inches thick, procedures of how to do things, there's a lot of information that comes into a recruit's mind during that 16 weeks. Then going back to the department to begin the field training program. Maybe that's something where after year 1 or year 2, they come back and do a refresher on constitutional law. Again, where they've had a little bit of experience of applying things, but now they're refocusing again, bringing in that information again that's important for them to do. So looking at core curriculums that could be beneficial of bringing to an officer once they graduate that basic police academy. We all attend the same academy, and we believe many of the classes mentioned are important enough that the same training should be provided to all officers so that there is a consistency throughout the state. We're a small state with many small agencies that depend on each other through mutual aid responses. The consistency of the training is important and crucial to further ensure we are operating from the same foundational training in these important areas. I believe Chief Edwards also mentioned that earlier in a question. Many of these thoughts, ideas, and recommendations would place a significant burden and additional requirements on PSTC that would require additional staff and funding to put them in place. I have confidence through my conversations with Director Skippa that he is desiring to make significant enhancements to move New Hampshire's police training forward to meet not only the needs of law enforcement in the 21st century, but also the expectations of the communities we serve. I'm now going to segue to the next section mentioned, which is policies and procedures. Both items govern law enforcement's day-to-day operations. Some policies are required by law, but the vast majority of policies are a choice of each individual agency. Most, if not all, police departments have existing policy manuals, and they vary in size from department to department. As law enforcement leaders and officers serving communities throughout New Hampshire, we face a variety of challenges, both large and small, with varying complexities, while also keeping up with legislative mandates and changes, training requirements, ensuring citizen and officer safety, and maintaining positive community relations. We depend on our policies and procedures to guide us through these and other complex issues. Policies and procedures should be reviewed and updated when appropriate to ensure we are following law enforcement best practices. There are a variety of reasons why an agency may revise or create a new policy, such as changes in procedures, encountering a new problem, equipment, technology, safety concerns, legislative changes, and through thorough investigations that reveal an issue. Each law enforcement department in the state is responsible for the creation and upkeep of their own policies and procedures. There is a core of policies that would be similar in title, similar in content, but still different. Not every department has the same policies for a variety of reasons, and one reason would be the size of the agency. For instance, you have a department with 2 to 3 officers versus a much larger department with over 200 officers. The larger department will have numerous divisions within the organization requiring additional policies and procedures to govern those operations. One of the areas I was asked to address was the difference in accreditation between accredited and non-accredited departments. First and foremost, there is no requirement, state or federal, for a law enforcement agency to be accredited, but it is considered a best practice. Just because an agency is not accredited does not imply or mean they're not doing a good job or not providing good service to their community. Most are doing that. Many non-accredited agencies get their policies and procedures from accredited agencies, which are always open and willing to share. As they say, no need to recreate something that already exists. The only accreditation option currently available to New Hampshire law enforcement is national accreditation through the Commission on Accreditation for Law Enforcement Agencies. The acronym is CALEA. This organization was founded in 1979 as a credentialing authority by joint efforts of the following major law enforcement executive associations: International Association of Chiefs of Police, the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives, National Sheriff's Association, Police Executive Research Forum. The benefits of CLEA accreditation are the following: increased community advocacy. Accreditation embodies the precepts of community-oriented policing. It creates a forum in which law enforcement agencies and citizens work together to prevent and control challenges confronting law enforcement and provides clear direction about community expectations. Number two, staunch support from government officials. Accreditation provides objective evidence of an agency's commitment to excellence in leadership, resource management, and service delivery. Thus, government officials are more confident in the agency's ability to operate efficiently and meet community needs. Number three, a stronger defense against civil lawsuits. Accredited agencies are better able to defend themselves against civil lawsuits. Also, many agencies report a decline in legal actions against them once they become accredited. Number four, a reduced risk and liability exposure. Many agencies report a reduction in their liability insurance costs and or reimbursement of accreditation fees. And number five, greater accountability within the agency. CLIA standards gives the CEO a proven management system of written directives, sound training, clearly defined lines of authority, and routine reports that support decision-making and resource allocation. Two major side benefits of accreditation process are, one, it requires an agency to develop a set of written directives that are industry standard best practices, comprehensive, well thought out, and uniform. This is one of the most successful methods for reaching administrative and operational goals while also providing direction to personnel. And two, the process can limit an agency's liability and risk exposure because it demonstrates that internationally recognized standards for law enforcement have been met, is verified by a team of independent, outside, CLIA-trained assessors through an audit process to ensure the department is following its policies and procedures. Although accreditation does not prevent all negative outcomes, it does set the course for success, provides a tool for review and ongoing measurement against stated objectives. It results in data which agency leadership use for policy decisions, as well as to share with community members and stakeholders. Throughout CLIA standards manuals, there is a clear commitment to procedural justice, ethical policing, community trust and engagement, transparency in service delivery, appropriate organizational culture, fairness in systems and processes, and consistency in what citizens should expect from their law enforcement agency. There is a cost to become nationally accredited through CLIA, and I know there's been some questions wanting to know what those costs are. And I can give you just a little bit of a brief. For an agency size of 1 to 24 employees, just to sign a contract with CLIA is almost $8,500. If you had an agency 25 to 199 full-time employees, it's almost $11,500. And then once you sign the contract, there's annual fees, and that annual fee for 1 to 24 employees is almost $4,000. 25 to 199 is about $4,600. And again, that's some of those upfront costs. There's also costs to meet those standards, and maybe it's making upgrades or changes to your evidence room. Maybe it's the security system, signage. There's some other costs to meet the standards that CLIA would set forth. And there's also some technology requirements of a specific software that you have to have called Power DMS that's also an additional cost. In addition, it also requires a significant amount of staff time to initially and then require someone within the department or an additional position or a contractor to manage the process on nearly a full-time basis, as there are required policy audits and site visits that need to take place in order to maintain accreditation. Another option that could be looked at would be a state accreditation model. Generally, it is more cost-effective for agencies, and currently models already exist in some other states. It's important to note that New Hampshire had a state accreditation system coordinated by PSTC and the New Hampshire Association of Chiefs of Police as an alliance, but the process was dissolved approximately 10-plus years ago as a result of a disagreement over the copyrights of CLIA standards. We have some advantages in New Hampshire by having one academy for training, but when it comes to policies and procedures, we could use a statewide accreditation program that is scalable to large and small agencies to ensure we all have the same basic standard operating procedures in one place. We believe the public would want to know if a three-person department will follow the same basic rules as a 30 or a 300-person department when it comes to conduct, use of force, and fair and impartial policing, just to name a few. Creating a state accreditation model is in an area that should be looked at again, realizing that to accomplish a joint effort with PSTC would require additional funding and staffing. With that, General, that concludes my presentation, and I'll open it up to questions if there's time.
Thank you, Chief, for that very good testimony. We have four minutes, and rather than cut someone off in the middle of their opportunity to question, I think I will suggest that we end our session today, and we'll pick up with questions for Chief Dennis on Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Thursday, July 2nd at 9:30 a.m. I want to apologize to members of the public who've been waiting to testify, and we will get to you on Thursday. But I think the commission and the public has greatly benefited from the three witnesses we've heard from so far, giving us some really excellent baseline information about training and curricula and policy and opportunities for improvement. If the member of the public does wish to testify, I remind you that it would be very helpful in terms of time management for you to, if you have not already, let us know through our email address, which is leact@doj.nh.gov, leact@doj.nh.gov. And unless any commission member has something they want to raise in the nature of new business or other business, I would entertain a motion to adjourn. Mr. Norton.
Director Skipper moves to adjourn.
1 minute, please. I think Mr. Norton had his hand raised.
Yes, General. I would suggest that when we finish with the questions for Chief Dennis, that we then move to testimony from the public before commission members offer testimony, because I know that people have been waiting, and I think it would be beneficial to have them jump ahead of us as commission members if we had testimony that we wanted to offer.
Yes, I agree, and that was my plan. Yep.
Great. Thank you.
Any other anything else from commission members?
I will second Director Skipa's motion to adjourn.
Okay, a motion from Director Skipa, second. I believe that was Attorney Jefferson.
Yes.
Thanks. It requires a roll call vote. Commissioner Quinn.
Yes.
Director Malachi.
Yes.
Director Skipa.
Yes.
Mr. Johnson.
Yes.
Mr. McKim.
Yes.
Judge Gardner.
Yes.
Lieutenant Morrison.
Yes.
Chief Dennis.
Yes.
Mr. Norton.
Yes.
Mr. Lascaz.
Yes.
Attorney Jefferson.
Yes.
Ms. Challa.
Yes.
And Chief Edwards.
Yes.
Motion carries. This meeting is adjourned. Have a nice weekend, everyone, and we'll talk next week. Thank you.
Thank you.